Good morning. I need to disclose right up front, I am not a lawyer.
Too bad, too bad.
Last evening I was telling my daughter, I have two children. I have a perfect daughter and I also have a son. I told my daughter what I was doing and speaking at a law symposium, and she said, but you're not a lawyer. And I said, well, no, and so she thought for a bit, and then she said, well, look, if you can't be good, be brief. So with that admonition to bolster my confidence, let me turn to my topic. And it's a serious topic. Civil rights. You know, yesterday marked the 50th anniversary of the third of the three civil rights marches from Selma to Montgomery, 50 years ago yesterday. And the three marches began on March 7th with a march that was aborted. In fact, the protesters never got beyond the Edmund Pettus Bridge before they were brutally turned back by state policemen. But of course, that march built on other activities that had come before. On February 26th of that same year, a man named Jimmie Lee Jackson, who was a civil rights leader but also a deacon in his church, was shot and killed by a state trooper during a peaceful protest in Marion, Alabama. So why were African American people protesting? At that time, they were working to have the Congress pass the Voting Rights Act. And in fact, they were successful. And their efforts led to the Voting Rights Act of 1965, a landmark piece of legislation, a strong and powerful support you might even say declaration of equal rights. But something happened a year before the Voting Rights Act, something also in 1964 of great import, and that was the passage of the Civil Rights Act. And so you may wonder why only a year after the passage of the Civil Rights Act did minority individuals have to go and protest and face brutality and all of the harshness of society that marginalized them to gain voting rights. It is an evolution. And the work to pass the Voting Rights Act of 1965 was a way of furthering the progress that was made. In no way was it to diminish the importance of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. That was and remains landmark legislation. But even the Civil Rights Act of 1964 did not come about in isolation. In fact, you might argue that the first civil rights steps that were taken as a matter of federal policy occurred on January 1, 1863, when President Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation. But the Emancipation Proclamation didn't confer equality. What it did is it eliminated slavery. But it was foundational to work that came later. People with disabilities are a minority. We suffer discrimination, and we suffer it based on public misunderstanding, stereotype, low expectations, in the same way that unreasoned and unreasonable assumptions about people from other groups, be they ethnic minorities, women, etc., deny them opportunities. So do we have civil rights comparable to the rights afforded to ethnic minorities as a result of the 1964 Civil Rights Act? Well, I think people would say, of course we do. Of course we do. It's the Americans with Disabilities Act, enacted into law 25 years ago this year. And it is absolutely true that the Americans with Disabilities Act ensures certain protections for people with disabilities and seeks to bar discrimination on the basis of disability. But, and without in any way demeaning or trivializing the importance of the Americans with Disabilities Act, I would argue that it is inherently separate and different from the civil rights protections afforded to others. And it is because disability, unlike membership in other defined groups, has the characteristic, the aspect of limited functioning. It might be motor functioning, it might be loss of vision, it might be impaired intellectual functioning. And as a result, there is an unspoken, yet unquestioned belief that people with disabilities are inherently limited by virtue of the characteristic of disability. And civil rights protections are extended to people who are not inherently inferior, not inherently damaged, but people whose opportunities have been unreasonably constricted by social convention. So we have civil rights, but in a qualified or limited degree. So what do I mean by this? What makes people with disabilities an orphan minority, a subordinate minority? A minority that gets close to equal status, but not quite there. If you look at the Civil Rights Act of 1964, it prohibits employment discrimination. And specifically, it bars discrimination in employment against people based on race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. And there is a comparable provision within the Americans with Disabilities Act. The ADA also bars discrimination on the basis of disability. However, it qualifies that protection. It says that you may not discriminate against a qualified individual with a disability. The Civil Rights Act does not use that language. It doesn't talk about a qualified member of a particular ethnic group, a qualified woman, a qualified person from a particular national origin, because it is understood implicitly that these are people whose opportunities have been denied based on prejudice, low expectations, and stereotype, but that these individuals are inherently equal. But our right to employment free from discrimination is not for all people with disabilities, only for qualified individuals. Well, what makes an individual with a disability qualified? The standard articulated in the ADA is that the individual with or without accommodations needs to be able to carry out the essential functions of the job. That seems fair enough. You need to be able to do the work. Who decides what are the essential functions of the job? Well, in the ADA itself, deference is given to the employer. The employer decides, and unless it can be demonstrated that the employer's definition of the essential functions are unreasonable, they determine whether the individual can perform those functions. And as I said, functions that are carried out with or without accommodations. But not all accommodations, only reasonable accommodations. In other words, our right to be protected from employment discrimination is only guaranteed provided it doesn't cost too much, provided that it's not too much bother for the employer. And what's the defense that the employer must offer if the employer is challenged that for failing to provide reasonable accommodations? It is the concept of undue hardship. You cost too much. You're too much bother. I believe the next step in the evolution of disability policy is to get recognition that the barrier that people with disabilities face, be it the barrier in education, social integration, employment, is socially constructed. And as such, people with disabilities are inherently equal individuals. We must line up our policies in support of this conception of disability, in support of a true rights-based model of disability. As you know, for 77 years, ever since its initial adoption, the Fair Labor Standards Act has included a provision, Section 14C, that allows people with disabilities to be paid below the minimum wage. What was the basis for the 14C exception? The basis was that people with disabilities are inherently less capable, less productive. These are damaged people, broken people, limited people, people who cannot be guaranteed the same wage as others. So we measure their productivity and assign their wage based on someone else's determination of their capacity to produce. 77 years later, we still have the 14C exemption, and it's time for that to end. It's time to quit creating and supporting segregated work settings that isolate people with disabilities, that perpetuate the idea of people with disabilities as being foreign and apart from the general society. And also, we must look at our income support and medical support systems. A very simple concept. Should disability, the costs associated with disability, should they be borne by the individual, or are these costs that should be distributed across society as a whole? We operate today under the former mindset. If you're poor and you haven't worked and you have a significant disability, you're eligible for Supplemental Security Income, SSI. But once you start earning some money and reach that magic point where your income is presumed to be enough for you to be self-sufficient, you lose your benefits, your cash benefits, your medical benefits. And we wonder why only 0.5% of people with disabilities ever leave the Social Security disability rolls. It is because our system does not recognize that disability, like many other things in our society, those costs should be distributed. And it would be so much better if we eliminated all means testing, both for SSI and SSDI. Put some money in the hands of people with disabilities to help meet their disability-related costs. Think of the money that would be saved if Social Security didn't have to keep reaffirming the poverty of millions of people each year. But it is not the economy, it's not the objective facts that have perpetuated this system. It is the mindset of disability. The idea that people with disabilities are broken people, damaged people, inferior people, people that deserve care, but damaged people nevertheless. We must replace the image of disability, the conception of disability, as automatically equating to inadequate or inferior performance with a true civil rights model of disability. And we must then align our programs and supports to support that new conception. Thank you very much.